Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Your lips can do a whole lot more than kiss. Your lips express love and speak your truth. Plump your lips with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC for natural-looking results that are completely and uniquely you. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. The Everyday Warrior concept is a no-hack, practical approach to living a fulfilling, purpose-driven life. The Everyday Warrior philosophy was actually built through my personal observations of high performers throughout my 20-year career in U.S. Special Operations. These high performers, much like you and I, are all battling something. But it doesn't change our desire for continual growth in the ability to achieve and sustain optimal performance. On the Everyday Warrior podcast, we seek out in-depth conversations from a multitude of industries or professions to discuss their failures, darkest moments, and of course, their time-tested principles or positive habits that have led them to success so that you and I may learn from them and accelerate our own journeys to attain success as well. In today's episode, we have a great guest, one of the most recognized and accomplished lead singers in rock and roll history. But that alone doesn't do Sammy Hagar justice. He's an accomplished entrepreneur, a New York Times bestselling author, a TV host, and someone that we can learn a hell of a lot from as we all strive to live our best lives. Without further ado, here's my interview with Sammy Hagar, the Red Rocker himself. Man, I know you can't drive 55, but it sounds like there's no letting up on the brakes anytime soon.
No, I'm like I said earlier to you, that when I wrote my book and when I read it back, my first book, Red, when I read it back, I just went, wow, like you've worked your whole life, dude. You know, it's like you realize that you just work, one project to the next, you know, one band to the next, never taking a break, never taking inventory, never looking back, just nose to the ground. And I decided I had to think about that. Is this what I want to do for the rest of my life? Or have I got enough? It's like, well, I don't even know what I got. And I don't take inventory. So I decided that, yeah, I like doing it. I like working. I'm a project guy. I like coming up, creating something and then following it through. Because I don't like just to create and then next. Let me find something new. I like to see it happen. And that's what I'm all about. And that's what I'll do the rest of my life. You know, my wife said, when are you going to stop? I can't. It's not a sickness either, because quite honestly, I've turned it into a thing that where I help a lot of people and I create a lot of jobs. And my goal now is to really, everything I do has a higher purpose. It's to give back, help people, help children, terminally ill children, my biggest, most horrible thing on the planet for any family, anybody has kids. You know, if you're child was terminally ill and 2 years to live, what would you do? And what if you were running out of money and couldn't even do what you had to do to make their life as good as it could be? So I'm all about that now. So it gives my entrepreneurial crazy drive more purpose, which is because I'm not greedy. It's not about money. I got more money than I could ever spend, but I like helping people. So now I got a reason to keep working. Makes me happy.
I'd love to hear that. And I was going to ask you, because I mean, you've accumulated wealth. So it's about impact, yeah, impacting people in their lives.
It is. It's about, you know, what can I do to help? And you go, well, you can, a lot of times you can just write the check, but it's so much better to give it personal. Make it on a personal level. I believe in charity to be in your backyard, right where you can feel it. You know people in your hometown that need it. I'm not going to send my money over to, you know, I hate to say Africa, use that as an example, but that's who needs the most help, you know, in this world. You know, that's a very starving country. You know, they run out of water, they don't have water. It's horrible. But I feel bad letting somebody have a homeless person in my backyard, you know, and sending money somewhere else. So I like doing it local and going down to the food bank and handing out food and talking to the people. Why are you here? You see a family, a guy, they're dressed nice. They got two or three kids and you're looking at them and you're going, why are you here? And they go, well, you know, I'm a gardener. My wife's a housekeeper and, you know, my truck needs tires and, you know, we're having a hard time making ends meet for our kids going back to school, got to buy books. So the food banks really help us because we get a couple meals a week or a couple meals a month here and it helps us make ends meet. That changed my life. I'm going, oh, man, that's so right on the money. You can really get hands on. So, you know, I'm learning stuff like that, having fun with it. When you want to feel love, you have to give love. You can't take it. Give me more love. I ain't feeling it. You're never going to feel it. You got to give it. And when you give it, you know, just completely unselfishly, then you go, wow, that felt really good. I want to do that again. And that's when the hook goes in and you're like me, you're in the boat filleted.
So I've had a lot of mentors tell me that is always give more than you take and it will come back around to you. Almost like drive impact and the money will follow. One of the focuses of this podcast, we call it the Everyday Warrior, is dissecting high performers and how they've lived their lives, the struggles they've gone through. And what people get wrong is they probably look at your life and they're like, oh, he's just been blessed. Which, you know, doing my research on you is not the case. You came from a rough upbringing, and I want to get into that. But you said something earlier that you just can't stop working. Do you find any joy in accomplishments, or do you move past those very quickly into the next project?
Oh, I feel tons of joy from accomplishments. That's my little self pat on the back, my little ego thing that makes me go, all right, I did it. You know, I knew I could do it. Because, you know, whenever you do crazy things like me, like starting a tequila company back in 1988, you know, nobody had done it yet. And everyone said, you're crazy. Or building the Cabo Wabo Cantina, you know, 30 some years ago in Mexico, dirt roads, one flight a week down there. Are you crazy? And you hear that and you have people quit working for you for it. Like my accountant quit when I built the Cabo Wabo, my first accountant back then. She said, you're crazy. I'm not going to sit here and finance something like this. It was like about $200,000 is all it was. I was a rock star. You know what I mean? So those people, when you accomplish, that's when you feel like I'm so glad I trusted my instincts. I'm so glad I did it. And it's not to say, see, I told you. I'm not an I told you guy. I'm a guy that for me inside, I'm going, keep listening to yourself, buddy. You got an angel here. You got one here. Listen to him. And when, you know, this guy's going, don't do it. Don't do it. Maybe don't do it. But not when he or she is saying to you, don't do it. Oh, because there's egos involved. There's jealousy involved. They don't see your vision one bit. But your little angels, they know what's going on. So which those angels, that's you. They're listening to yourself. Makes me feel good.
So personally for you, if you have conviction about a certain idea, despite naysayers talking about the risk that you're assuming, you're usually the type of guy that's you're just gonna run through that wall if necessary.
Absolutely. I'm the craziest guy in the world. If I have a fault, it's I cannot see the downside. I do not see it. When I have a vision of something that drives me to say I'm gonna do that, I see clear to the end of the tunnel. I don't have just the little tip of the iceberg. I usually see a bigger, more, I go, no, I can see where this is going. I can see how far it's gonna go. I mean, not always, but most of the time I can see way down that road. And it's hard to explain that to people. And I don't like wasting my time doing it. You know, there's a lot of time wasted with ideas. Sometimes people talk them out so much, then they lose interest in the freaking idea. They've told everybody so much. And I learned that later on in life, that keep it in there. And just, you know, if they don't see your vision, yeah, they don't belong in your world for that project, you know? Yeah, I don't see a downside. I mean, it's a fault. you know, I have had some failures from that, you know, where I didn't see, oh, wow, I didn't realize that would happen. Oh, no, I didn't realize that could even happen, you know, so.
So I want to step back to your upbringing, because to say you had a rough childhood, I don't know if that characterizes it the best, but you grew up poor. You were always moving. Your father was from what I read, one tough, you know, man. How did some of those experiences shape the person that you are today, or shape you to face the adversity that you faced as you came up the ranks within the rock and roll world?
Well, Mike, I can tell you rock and roll is made for people like me, because the gratitude you get from the fans when you do make it, and even when you're just starting out, you know, you just go out and play in front of people that never heard of you, you feel like somebody up there, you know what I mean? And when you were beaten down your whole life and came so poor, embarrassment, you know, with your girlfriends, fathers wouldn't let me come to their house. I mean, I'm talking before I had a car, you know, I'd walk over my girlfriend's house. My dad go, oh, Sammy Hagar, is your father, is that Robert? Yeah, he goes, get the hell out of my house. What did I do? Find out my dad beat the shit out of the guy in a bar. You know what I mean? So I'm coming from that place where, you know, just rock and roll is a great spot to land. So is what made all that thing, that embarrassment and the being poor and struggling to, you know, have enough money to buy a new shirt to wear to school the next year, or a new pair of shoes, you know, because my mom was poor. We went and picked berries, and I think, you know, it's all in my book, but, you know, we picked fruit in the summer. My whole family, 5 o'clock in the morning, load up down at the berry patch with all Hispanics and pick berries so I can make $10, you know, in a week or whatever it was to buy a new pair of shoes and a t-shirt, you know. And that stuff makes my work ethic, I mean, what I do now is nothing compared to that. You know, getting your hands all scratched up and then berries, and carrying a flat, you know, a little old guy carrying a 35-pound flat of berries down there and having to put it on the scale, and the lady puts her foot under it, says, oh, you're short a little bit, you know, go back and pick two little baskets. She was putting her foot under there, lifting it up, taking a couple ounces off, you know what I mean? That makes what I do for a living very easy. But is what it did is it drove me to want to get out of that. And as a teenager, the first thing you want to do is get away from it. So you go start doing drugs, you start partying, you start robbing houses or stealing gas, which I did all that, you know, but not proud of it. But, you know, I rather than go down that road, music saved me. But during those hard times like that, where I could have went the wrong way, I was so determined to get out of that rut. And my friends were going to jail now. Now we're driving cars. My friends are stealing cars, stealing, you know, tires off of cars and selling them and, you know, all this crazy stuff. And I was doing it. And I thought, man, I do not want to go to jail. I've been lucky so far, you know. So, but I was driven to keep going and not take the easy way out. So I picked up a guitar and I never set it down.
Would you say that you found music or music found you?
I think music found me. When I heard the Stones, Satisfaction, or whatever their first song, I forget what it was, but one of those songs, and they hadn't come to America yet. I got to see their first American concert at the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino. George Babcock from 590 AM radio brought the Stones to town, and man, that I said, I forget it. You know, I went to see Eric Clapton with Cream's first American performance on the West Coast at the Whiskey, and I went and stole the guitar the next day. I said, I need a guitar like that. I went and stole it out of a freaking music store. Not proud of that either. But I think music found me, and I loved it. I could sing. I would be with my buddies in a car. We'd drive down to the beach, you know, or something, and they'd have the radio on. We'd have the radio on, a bunch of guys in the car, and I'd sing along to every song. And then my buddies get all pissy. They say, man, how do you know all these songs? How do you know the words to these songs? I said, I just know the words. I don't know. You know, I didn't study them. And they'd turn the radio off. Oh, yeah, what about this song? I'd say, hey, you know, what about blah, blah, blah? I'd start singing the song and sing the words. They go, man, I mean, they weren't pissed off, but, you know, they were like on my ass about it. Like, he's pulling some shit, man. He's got it written down somewhere or whatever, you know. So I was geared for music, man. I learned to play guitar like that. I could sing any song immediately. I mean, I could sing any song. I'd sing an Elvis Presley song. I could sing a Frank Sinatra song. I could sing a fucking Beach Boys song, a Beatles song, you know. And how much fun was that compared to picking berries?
Did the vocals? I never picked berries, but I served in special operations. That was tough work.
Yeah.
My body doesn't miss it. Did the vocals come natural to you, or did you have to go through coaching like a lot of singers
Never.
Do?
Never. I'm thinking about taking vocal lessons now because I just came off a little 3-week tour and I was struggling a couple nights, you know, when the weather was wrong. We were in really cold climate, you know, like snowing back in New Jersey. And I had a tough time singing from having the heaters on in the hotel room and in the cars, drying me out, and then get out in the ice cold and then go up and try to sing. So first time in my life, I've ever started having a few difficulties. You know, I'm 74, so it's like everybody's been wondering when it was going to happen. So I'm thinking about seeing a vocal coach and see if there's something I'm doing wrong because, my throat was just getting hard to hit the big high notes. And I've never had that problem. Yeah, natural singer, completely.
No one will ever doubt that music was your biggest passion. My question to you is music still your biggest passion now?
No, helping people is my first love now. Music is probably second, and it's probably would be first if I didn't have the ability to do what I'm doing with giving back. And, you know, that's half my business drive is all my beach bar and grills that I own in airports, Maui, Honolulu, Cleveland, and Vegas. That money goes to that community. All the money goes to those communities right there. Like I said, backyard. We ain't shipping it over across country or anything. Every now and then I do something else. But when I go on tour, I give back to food banks. I give $2,500 in every city I've played for the last 13 years. That's a lot of cities and a lot of money, and it's good money. So music, it's kind of like all rolled up in one ball now. And I think that's important that when you can put everything together, I don't have to change my hat. You know, I don't have to sit there changing hats all the time and change my mentality. It's really about having more businesses that don't stress me out, where I have people that can run them, and then giving the money away to organizations. And then I go play music for fun, and it gives me a chance to go out and spread the love to people. You know, going on stage and playing for 10,000 folks or whatever, not only feels so good to me. I mean, I look at these people. I go out to make people happy. Somebody says, you know, what's your goal when you walk out and say this? Oh, man, make people have it. Forget about their troubles for 2 hours, have the time of their life, and hopefully wake up at least even the next morning with a big smile on their face and say, man, I had an awesome time last night. That's what I'm out there to do. That makes me feel good. You know, so it's selfish. See, it's a form of
selfish. Talking. When you're doing it to make other people happy, I don't think that's selfish at all. I was talking to a buddy here in the office who knew this was coming up, and he said, "Dude, I remember seeing Van Halen in San Antonio in the early '90s, and we had just lost a friend, and somehow somebody got the message to Sammy when you were with Van Halen." And you dedicated a song to that individual, and he said the whole stadium just erupted at just the fact that you would take time to recognize one person. But it's amazing. People remember those concerts for their life. Do you remember Van Halen in 88 here or there? And it's almost like a part of whatever stage they were in life. I mean, that's powerful, man.
It is. And I it's nothing. For me, like, you know, my famous saying is, easiest part of my job, what, remembering that this guy had a friend and he's in the audience, he was there tonight, had a ticket, a third row, but he died or he's in the hospital. I can't go up there and say, hey, man, John was supposed to be here, but John, I got goosebumps on my legs, right, from head to toe, knowing what that feels like when I do it. I can't imagine what it does to the person, you know, so, yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. That's called an exchange of energy that is just, that's what God's all about, you know, is, you know, you feel something, man.
So the early days with music, this wasn't an overnight success. I mean, the first few bands you were in struggled. You actually moved back to SoCal in 70, shortly after you had a child. And then all of a sudden, success started to hit. Was there a moment that you hesitated and maybe thought you needed to reassess your goals as it came to music, especially after you had a child? I don't know if it was paying the bills at the time. Was there a moment that you maybe double guessed if this was the route for you?
No, not a chance. I'd say I'd never see a downside. No. I'm the luckiest guy in the world too. Like I work really hard. for my luck. but my wife got pregnant. I was 20 years old. I was working in a nightclub making no money. All of a sudden, I thought, what am I going to do? I got to take her to the hospital. So I go to the hospital to get a checkup for her. She was pregnant, you know. And the doctor says, you know, I mean, the hospital says, you have insurance? Or no. You know, you have any money? No. What are you going to do? The lady goes, go sit down. And I go sit down with my wife. She calls somebody in. They take me in a room. They make me fill out all these papers. And they put me on welfare. Next thing I know, I got food stamps. I got a check coming in. And I got free medical. And I had no idea about what it was. My mother would never go on welfare. My mother, we went and picked berries. You know what I mean? She did ironings. We did yard work, whatever we had to do. It saved me. I mean, it really saved me. I had my baby, you know, my first son was born. So it allowed me to keep playing music. Otherwise, I would have done something, of course, because I'm a person that does not just slack. You know, I've never been like that. So I would have taken care of business some other kind of way. But I said, man, I'm on welfare. This is swinging. Man, my band's over at my house eating. We got food stamps. You know, we're eating, baking a big old pot of spaghetti, you know. It really saved me. It was a miracle that happened at that time of my life. So, but then when my wife had the baby, they made me see a psychiatrist because, you know, they kept saying, what are you going to do? My counselor, whatever you call the person that puts you on welfare and you have to go and do meetings every now and then. How are you doing? You got a job yet? Where are you looking for a job? Well, I'm not looking for a job. I'm a musician. The guy called me Peter Pan. He's going, you know, go ahead. You got to raise this kid, your wife on welfare. I mean, he belittled me. And I'm sitting there going, oh, man, I got to listen to this. You know, I got long hair and kind of dressed like a freak, you know, like a hippie back then. And I ignored it. I kept going. And pretty soon I got a paying musician job that where I could make enough money to get off welfare. And then I remember when Montrose, another crazy situation, I'm jumping around a little bit. I mean, this was 68, 69, 70. Then in 72, yes. Almost 73, when I got into Montrose, I was on unemployment from a job that I had, a part-time job that I did, so I could kind of get a little bit of extra money while I was working. It was a moonlighting situation. So I was collecting unemployment from just a little short job I had. And the lady goes, oh, okay, you know, you got to fill these papers out for next week or for next month's unemployment. And I said, no, I don't need it, man. I just got a record deal with Montrose. We got a record deal. They're sending me, no, you got to come in and fill these papers out. And they were trying to give me money. And I said, no, I'm not taking the money. I've got money because we got a $50,000 advance and I got $5,000. We each got $5,000. And the risk went for good, but it was enough to move into a house, pay the rent, you know, for X amount of time. It was just the last minute. I mean, it's like I was re-signing up for unemployment and I got in Montrose. We got a record deal. So I am a lucky son of a gun. There's no question about it. But like I said, I worked hard for my luck.
You keep saying hard work. I've got to ask this question because I'm not a musician and you spent your whole life in the industry. Did you outwork the musicians around you? Did you have a stronger work ethic? Were you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, back when the guy would be, everybody would say, hey, you know, let's go out and do this, go out and do that. I stayed home with my record player. I was learning Eric Clapton licks. I was learning, you know, songs. I was really honing my craft. And when it came time to get jobs, all these uppity musicians would say, oh, man, I'm not going to go play in that bar and play top 40, man. I'm going to write my own shit. And I'd say, well, I'm not. I'm going to write my own stuff, too. But I need some money. And I go knock on bar doors. And, yeah, I pushed. I never stopped. Once again, same thing. I'd get in my car and drive 4 hours for a gig. I put my guitar in the back. I heard about it. I'd say they're doing jam sessions in this place in Palm Springs. So round trip would be like 4 hours from San Bernardino when I lived there in Fontana. And I'd say, man, I put my guitar in the back. I'm going down there, man. I'm spending all my money on gas. You go there, sit in the audience and wait. Hey, can I play? Yeah, okay, come on up, man. What do you know? I know Born on the Bayou. Okay, let's do that. And everybody's going, hey, that guy's pretty good. You know, and then, I mean, I was a full-time guy. When I first got my guitar, when my friends were doing drugs, and then, you know, they'd be saying, hey, man, let's go get fucked up. Let's go get in a fight. Let's go, you know, believe it or not, the guys I used to hang with like to go to the next town over and get in fights. They'd pull into the hamburger stand, a car full of guys, and they'd be like outnumbered 10 to 1. And they get out and start choosing people up. And I'll be sitting, oh, fuck. So I would stay home and play my guitar after a while. I said, man, I don't feel like doing that tonight. So, you know, I always, music saved my ass, man. And it could save other people. If you're interested in music, go. Don't ever not do it.
Follow your passion. Now, when you get to the level that you are at now in Van Halen and Montrose, does that get even worse? I mean, are you guys practicing nonstop, or does the industry start to pull you away from honing the craft because you've got to do TV appearances, video appearances?
No.
What was that like, trying to maintain that level of performance?
You know, honestly, going on tour, playing in Montrose, we played 7 nights a week. And we would have played 2 nights and 2 shows in 1 night if we could have. But no, we loved it. I didn't want to do anything else. That is better than practice any day, because you get to practice in front of an audience and you get paid. You know, we weren't getting paid a lot of money by any means, but we were making a living. You know, I was seeing the light. I was seeing, hey, we're getting somewhere. When I got fired from Montrose, Ronnie fired me right before it looked like we were about to make it. You know, we had 2 records out. Second record did better than the first, even though the first one ended up being, you know, our biggest seller from all time. I thought, oh man, we're going to make it. And Ronnie fires me. You know, we're in Paris. I'm sick as a dog. I got food poisoning. And we're pulling up to the only place we ever headlined in our life, except Winterland in San Francisco, our hometown, and in Paris. And Ronnie goes, pulls up in the car. He's going, hey, after this show, it's the last, I caught the last tango in Paris. He's going, after this show tonight, he's going, I'm going to quit the band. What are you going to do? I'm sick. I'm about to shit my pants, you know, and I'm sick in my stomach. And I go, I guess I'm going to start a new band. I went out and did the last show, got on an airplane, went home. I rolled up my sleeves, called my bass player and a drummer from the band. Said, you guys want to start a band? Yeah. Ronnie quit, right? Then Ronnie comes back, steals my drummer. So I take his little brother. I mean, you can't stop. You can't stop. I could have been a good Navy SEAL, you know.
I have no doubt, no doubt about that.
Ain't no quit me, brother.
I'm starting to realize that. So we're going to take a mid-roll break, but before we do, we ask 2 hard questions. Again, these questions are for the audience to learn. First question is, what's the hardest decision you've ever had to make?
I don't think I've ever had to make a tough decision. You know, I've always said, I know which path I'm going to go. I'm going there. I'm there. I remember when I was 21, sitting on a guy's couch, my pregnant wife sleeping in a chair next to me. I was sleeping on the floor in a couch with 2 other band members. And we were talking because we were trying to get a job in San Francisco. And we were talking and everyone was saying, here's what I want to do, man. I want to do this. I want to do that. I was saying, for some reason, I had this visual of a high road and a low road. And I thought I could go this high road where I could be about money and really focus on things. But I swear to you, I had nothing in my head. I said, I want to be with the people. I don't want to be, I almost related it to, God, it was such a weird thing. It was just like a psychedelic experience. I decided I was going to go the way of the people. I was going to go the way of Jesus. You know what I mean? I was going to say, I'm going to do everything I can do to help people. And I don't want to do anything wrong. It's like, I never want to fuck anybody over. You know what I mean? These other guys talking, man, we can do this, we got, and we couldn't do shit. But I made that decision. Maybe that was a tough decision because I had nothing and I decided I was okay with it until something was good going to happen. And it was like a faith, a weird faith thing. It wasn't about Jesus. I just used that as an example. You know, chose to walk the earth and help people and, hey, deal with it. You know what I mean? So that maybe that.
That's a damn good answer. Second one is, biggest regret in your life, the one wish you or the one you wish you could go back and change, maybe the outcomes.
No regrets, because where I ended up is where I wanted to be, and it's much more than I ever wanted to be. So absolutely, man. They, you know, getting my ass kicked a couple of times, that shit was good for me. No regrets. I'd do it again if I had to. That's for sure.
Amen.
I wouldn't go, yeah. Okay.
Then we're on. Amen.
Woo, you gave me goosebumps. There they are.
Yeah, every step has brought you here. Good.
That's right.
Okay, well, guys, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. And we're back with Sammy Hagar, the Red Rocker.
Yes, we are. We
guys,
are back.
Guys, you've got to listen to the first part. Sammy, we covered music, what's brought you here. Man, How many companies and foundations do you have right now? Because I'm running through the list. It seems like 10 to 15.
I really don't. I don't take inventory. I have a Hagar Family Foundation, which is my giving thing. I don't accept money. People are always trying to send me money. And I'm going, no. I'm not going to touch your money. I have a foundation so that when I give a dollar, it goes directly. I don't have to pay 50% in taxes. It all goes directly to what I want to do. That's why I started a foundation. It's wonderful if you're a giver. So it's what I do. When I give, I start a business. I use the money to give. You come to my business, make sure my business is successful. Buy my T-shirts, buy my tickets to the show. I will do the giving. Don't worry. You know what I mean? So my fans, I don't ask them to send me money. And people that go on the internet and say, hey, they pretend to be me and say, hey, send some money to this and for that. I would take those people and whip their ass so bad if I get my hands on them for trying to con my fans. My fans know I don't take their money. I take buy my tickets, buy my T-shirts, buy my booze, come to my restaurants, all that stuff, and let me do the giving. You know, you people just enjoy yourselves. So that's my system. And I got, Beach Bar rum. I got Sammy's Beach Bar cocktails only in Texas, California, and Nevada, coming to Florida soon. There's the rum. My cocktails are made from sparkling rum. That's world class rum. My cocktails are made from that, and they're delicious. They're better than all that stuff out there. And I'm telling you, they are. That's why I made it. Everyone says, "Why don't you make wine?" I'm saying, because I can't outdo a Romani Conti or a Vegas Sicilia's or Mouton Rochon, my favorite wines. I can't do it, but I can outdo those damn cocktails you're drinking. I can tell you that, and I can make better rum, and I can make better tequila. So. That's what I do. So my tequila, I think, is the best in the world. I think my rum's the best in the world. And I know my cocktails are the best in the world because I tried every one of them dogs out there. But that's why I got in the business. Everyone says, why are you doing this one? I said, because I can do something better. It's like elevated.
How did you sort of get this passion in spirits? How did you feel that, you had a taste for which rum was better, what tequila is better? I mean, what really drove you? Because it seems like you've really done a niche focus on this, wine, spirits, alcohol industry, and you've crushed it. I mean, Cabo Wabo Tequila, you sold that back in 2008, and then you've started a few more companies. What was it about spirits that just drove you to that industry?
When I was growing up in, going to high school, when we weren't supposed to be drinking, for some reason, the store that was easiest for my buddy to go. We had this big heavy set guy. We'd have a big jacket. He'd go into this certain store and he would always steal a bottle of tequila. he could get it in there, down his pants, walk around the store, go buy a pack of gum. We get running through the field. Oh, we got tequila. And it was rot gut tequila. But, the whole idea of lime and salt when we had a chance to do it, somewhere with that was a ritual. I really loved it. But I wasn't a drinker. I mean, I would do one or two shots and I couldn't drink more than a whole one beer. I was never a drinker. My dad was an alcoholic. First of all, died in the streets. I was not a big drinker. So when I started Cabo Wabo, I went down to Mexico. This is 83. I bought a place in Cabo in 1983. My buddy goes, hey, we're right here in the town of Tequila. Let's go to Tequila in Guadalajara. It's where all the tequila comes from. I said, oh, where? Jalisco. Yeah, 45 minutes. Let me show you. I'm going, man, tequila, woo. So he takes me to all these places, restaurants, and we hang out for a couple of days and stayed there. It's beautiful, buying furniture. And I tasted 100% agave tequila. This is back in 1983, 84. Nobody had. Our tequila you and I were drinking had worms in it, had a worm in it. It was mixto. It was not 100% agave, false color, everything about it. So when I tasted real tequila, it blew my mind. I said, holy shit, man, this is going to blow people's mind. I want to build a place where I'm going to, a tequila bar down in Cabo. Guy's going, we'll find a place. Okay, my buddy Jorge still runs the place, still my partner. When I tasted it and when I turned people onto it, they freaked out. Everyone said, I can't drink tequila. Every person I knew, I'd say, hey, what? Try this tequila. I can't drink tequila. Are you crazy? In college, I killed, hugged too many toilets. Everyone had the same story. I changed their mind. So when I came out, it was a huge success because it blew everything out of the market. The only other tequila that was 100% agave at that time was Patron. They came out the same year. That's my buddy, John DeGiorio. And then they went bam because he spent like $10 million on it to get it. And I didn't spend a penny on Cabo Wabo because I'm going, how am I going to have a big tequila company? So anyway, I had a palate and I developed it. And I went down and I made Cabo Wabo as my baby. I just decided that when that happened, it was another one of those things that was a miracle. It's a dream I didn't dream, but came true beyond my dreams. The type of money that it generated and the success it has. World's number two selling premium tequila at one time, Cabo Wabo. So when I sold it, I realized I had a real good passion for palate, for fine things. So I couldn't make tequila again. So I said, I want to make rum. That's the other one that's undervalued. Most rums are nasty. You know, white rum, yeah, you know, you got to mix them. Rum's for mixing. So I wanted to make a white rum that was palatable by itself. And I used to call it rum rock, my rum rocks. You could have it on the rocks. So that it just, I've got a palate. My grandfather was a chef. I'm a great chef myself. I'm telling you right now, ask all my chef friends, ask Guy Fieri, he'll tell you, I can cook. I know my way around a kitchen. So I have a palate and a nose. That's all it takes to make a good product. You know, taste it yourself, get involved.
It sounds like, you know, the palate is one part of the equation, but you've shown just this unique ability to commercialize things, to create these brands. Did that come from being in the rock and roll industry and watching that industry and how to market things, how to commercialize things? Where did that business acumen that you've clearly developed, where did that come from?
Well, it ain't business, it's marketing. Because business-wise, I'm not a good businessman. Yeah. Everyone thinks I am. I make good products and I make good decisions. But as far as running a business, I find a person that can run it before I start a business, I can tell you right now. But, you know, the marketing side of it, it's just like rock and roll. We used to go to the radio stations and get the DJ to play your record. You know, whether you took brought a hooker in there for him, or whether you rolled him a joint or gave him a line of coke, you know, bring him a bottle of tequila, whatever you had to do to get that DJ's attention back in the old days when they used to have DJs that played your music and they'd play your record. Well, I said, the booze industry is the same way. You got to get to the bartender. So when somebody pulls up to the bar and said, yeah, I have a margarita, or I have a shot of tequila. The guy goes, hey, have you tried Santo? Have you tried Cabo Wabo? So I went to work on that. And when I went on tour, I invited the bartenders and mixologists to my shows. I invited the salespeople that owned various bars in that town to my shows. And I made drinks on stage. I had waitresses bring them to me. And that's how I promoted it. It was unique. It would have cost probably $30 million to launch a brand the way I launched it. For $50,000, I never spent another penny. Cabo Wabo for the tequila.
That sounds like the smart way.
Warren Buffett asked me to speak at his Warner Summit one time for 1,100 of his CEOs and presidents of his companies. And I said, when my book came out, and I said, I sat in a room with Warren. I said, Warren, why would you ask me to talk to these people? I'm intimidated by this crowd. I'm going to have to walk out there and sit with Becky Quick. You know, and she's going to ask me questions. I mean, this is out of my league. And he goes, no, it ain't. He's going, you think different. He goes, I want these guys to think like you. You know, he said, you know, you spent $50,000 and made a $100 million deal on that within 5 or 6, 8 years, and, you know, nine, I think it's 9 years. And he says, these people need to learn how to do that. It was quite the compliment from Warren. He's going, no, I want you think out of the box, you know, different.
Is Cabo still is that your spot? What was it about Cabo that drew you in? I mean, because Sammy Hagar has become almost synonymous with you know, Cabo San Lucas or Los Cabos. And you've actually been inducted as an honorary ambassador. And I asked one person, he's like, he's not an honorary ambassador. He's the shadow governor of Cabos, Los Cabos. So What was it about Los Cabos?
It's really hard to explain. It's a magical place. It's where the ocean meets the desert. And my two favorite things, I love the desert because of the tranquil, the spiritual feeling. You feel at night, it's quiet. You know, there's something about the desert. You know, I think anybody will tell you, you get out in the desert by yourself late at night, it's spiritual. My two favorite things, hot weather, Mexican food, mariachi band, you know, tequila. It's like, it hit me. I went there because Keith Richards got married there to Patty Hansen. I don't remember what year it was, but it was before I ever went there. And I saw pictures. And the next year I went and stayed Twin Dolphin, same place, the whole nine yards. And it put a hook in me. I just said, man, I could live here forever. And I lived down there for 1 year with our kids. We put them in school, and they were my youngest daughter was in third or fourth grade, and my youngest daughter was in preschool. And we put them in school for 1 year, cold turkey, man. They learned a little Spanish from our housekeepers and stuff, but and from my partners, but they learned how to speak Spanish fluent, and it was the fastest year of my life. I went down there to slow down, and I wake up one morning, Kari, my wife, says, what do you want to do about the kids in school? We're going to have to call, you know, back to Mill Valley. Are we going back to Mill Valley and put the kids back in school? I said, what? School? She goes, yeah. And I said, we've been here a year? And she said, yeah. I couldn't believe it. I fucking couldn't believe it. I'm going, this is the fastest year of my life. I went down there to slow down, and it was accelerated evolution. So that's how magic it is. You're very in the moment, and the moment lives there for me. Everyone, you know, Jimmy Buffett found, you know, the keys. That was his magical enlightening where he wrote. Well, I write down there, and I think down there, and I love my life down there. And having the Cabo Wabo, so when I want to drive 30 minutes into town and jump on stage and rock my ass off, I can do it. Go downtown, you know, have some great Mexican food. I love Mexican food. If Mexican food and Italian food, that's all I need. You can, you know, I'll eat anything and cook anything. But if I had two things for the rest of my life, it'd be those two. If I only had one, I don't know if I could make that decision.
Anyone who tells you they don't like Mexican food, there's something off with them right away. I would agree with you wholeheartedly. So I want to point out, so March 29th, you've got a new book coming out. Are you excited about this one? It's Sammy Hagar's Cocktail Hits, your 85 personal favorites from the Red Rocker. Give us a little insight. And again, if you're listening to this, go to Amazon and purchase the book. What drove you to write this one?
Well, I've been writing this book for 30 years. You know, since I really discovered tequila and had been in that business, I've met so many great bartenders. I can't walk into a bar without a bartender saying, hey, dude, you got to try it. I got something I want you to try. And I've had some of the best freaking drinks ever made in my entire life. I mean, for anybody. I mean, and I've learned a lot about how to do that, just like cooking. I wrote a cookbook, too, because my grandfather, my mother, all my chef friends. This book, it's so hip because the guy that I wrote it with, he really brought it out of me because I said, I don't want to go through this. Writing a book takes time. I mean, you got to work your ass off. So it's a lot of hours, a lot of hours. And you got to make sure it's right. I don't want to put my name on a book and say, here's my book. And I say, I didn't write this fucking book. So this guy said, let me do all the heavy lifting. I'll go to all those bartenders. You don't have to call them up. You don't have to do shit. You just give me the list of who it is and what drink you had. And I had to put all this together. He went out and talked to the guys, called them up, got them on the phone, got the recipes. We put them in a book. And then it's my favorite recipes. The things I've learned from mixologists that have, you know, always trying to blow my mind with my brands. Even when you have a tequila brand like Cabo Wabo, my distributors have mixologists because they have 700 other brands that they, you know, so they got these great guys. And the first thing they do is they say, hey, we got to invent some really great drinks. So I sit down with these guys. So I just had all these notes and I had all these things in my head and I can shake them up pretty good. I can mix up some pretty good cocktails. So I had to make the book. But what we did that made it unique, it's not just a cocktail book. It shows you how to throw a certain kind of party. It tells you what you'll need at your bar if you're going to have this kind. You want to throw a tiki party, you know, Hawaii style, like what I did when I lived in Hawaii. You want to use rums and you're going to use all these. It gives you a list of ingredients and a list of everything you need, even how to dress. I took pictures in the book where I would dress the part for that kind of a party. What kind of music to play? I give you five examples on how to throw five different kinds of parties. And you'll never need another cocktail book again, and it'll help you kick your party up in the ass because all my fans expect me to throw parties for them all the time in Cabo and in my restaurants and in, you know, my tours. Well, someday I ain't gonna be around to throw those parties for you. So this is my legacy.
Sammy, you may have just saved my marriage. I have no doubt you may have just saved my marriage because my wife says I've got zero taste in anything. I'm just going to follow the blueprint in your book and throw a party.
It's
just
a manual.
Totally, blow her out of the water.
It's the party manual.
Well, Sammy, I know your time is valuable. And so is it safe to say you guys are mid-tour right now? Because I know the tour technically kicked off.
We're just kind of starting. We just went out for 3 weeks and we're doing a bunch of, I don't know, George Thorogood's going out with me. Now, you want to talk about a booze tour. That's going to be a blast. Yeah, we're just doing shows. Got residencies in Vegas. They're all sold out and 12 shows. We're doing our last three this weekend, and then we're going to put three more on sale, I think. And then that's it, because I got to do the birthday bash in Cabo again this year. Finally, the birthday bash will be back in Cabo. COVID took a bite out of everything. And we just try to work around the system. Like, you can't stop me. COVID didn't stop me. We did the birthday bash. We went to Catalina and did it on the beach for boats. You brought your boat, pull your boat up to the harbor. We played for free on the beach. And that was one of the coolest things I've ever done. I love doing things that I've never done before. The Circle made a new record. It's called Crazy Times, and with David Cobb, the great producer in Nashville. And it's not a country record, but it's a great record. And we're coming out with that this year, but there's a song in there called Father Time. And it's about my life. It's the best song I ever wrote in my life. If I never wrote another song again, as long as I lived, I would say I wrote that song, you know? And there's a line in there saying, when was the last time you did something for the first time? And that's kind of it's the way I live my life now. I say, hey, I've never done that before. Let's go. You know what I mean?
Frontline shit. That is how we keep it interesting.
Frontline shit.
Well, so for the listeners, if you want to follow the tour, if you want to get tickets, go to redrocker.com. Yeah. I know you've got the list of concerts. My wife has already said, hey, you name the place, we're going out there. So we look forward to seeing you. We don't know what city yet, but we'll be in the cheap.
Well, let me know, Mike. I want to make sure you have the time of your life and make it easy for you.
I appreciate that. And again, she's your biggest fan because you treated her father just... Wow. I don't want to say a simple stage hand. You treated him like he walked on water, and he always remembered that, and he was your biggest fan. Again, for the listeners, we want to close this out with two questions. First one, how will Sammy Hagar measure his life and if he lived it well?
Wow. Well, number one, I would have to say, was it a good life? Was I happy in the end? Was I happy?
Yeah.
And the answer to that so far is definitely yes. And was it worth it? All the work? Yes, absolutely. How many dreams came true? Like, you want to put a goal on it? How many dreams came true? More than I ever expected. There's a positive. So yes, we're still happy. How many people did I help? You know, did I do enough? You know what I mean? Like, to me, that's going to be the big judgment someday. It's like, damn it. You know, now I'm here laying here on my deathbed going, I fucking should have. I never did that. And I should have did that. I got to make sure that I complete that list, or feel like at least, well, I did all I could. And did I make a difference for anybody? You know, that's a big deal. I think if I had enough people say you made a difference in my life, which I think I'm doing pretty good on that one, then yeah, that's the way I would measure it.
That's deep.
Yeah.
And I'd say you've knocked all of those out of the park, and that's not a question you have to ask yourself.
I'm still up to bat, though, Mike. Mike, I'm still up to bat.
I know.
Whoa, low and inside.
I have no doubt in 2040, I'll be watching you live in concert. I have no doubt. So, last question. We all look, you know, you mentioned Warren Buffett, who I'm assuming you consider a good friend and a mentor on the business side. Well, a lot of people view you as a mentor. So what are Sammy Hagar's maybe 1 to 3 keys to success, those rules that you've always lived by?
Number one, don't ever fuck anybody. I don't want to get fucked, and I ain't out to fuck nobody. It's all about, okay, win, win, win. That's a big rule to me. If I feel that one little inch of, somebody's going to get fucked, I run. I'm out of there quick. Number one, don't ever want to fuck anybody. You have to have a good idea. You have to believe in it. I mean, like, really believe in it, and put 100% of everything you've got available to make it come true. Otherwise, success is tough, man. You know, especially a big, crazy, new, fresh, original idea. Got to believe. Make sure it's a good idea. You know, you're not going to sell a bad idea to nobody. And it's really quality and commitment. And like I'm telling you, keep that rule in your pocket. If don't ever fuck anybody. There's no reason to. Everybody can win, and that'll keep you clean. You can live with yourself.
I love that, and Sammy, I couldn't agree. And that one's definitely going in my toolbox. I know there's a lot of listeners right now that agree with that. And you know, sadly, I've done wrong by some people, but there's still a lot of time for me to go back and rectify that mistake. But
forgiveness is easy. That's the easiest job in the world. People don't realize how easy it is to really forget. Your ego won't let you do it. But, you know, I've made mistakes, too. I've gotten headbutts with people. You know, Eddie Van Halen, I look back at some of the times where I could have been, I could have chilled it out, but my ego was saying, oh yeah, well, fuck you, you know, instead of saying, hey, I love you, man. You know, forgiveness is, that's the easiest job on the planet. Get out there and do it, man.
Well, Sammy, I cannot thank you enough for joining us. We know you, you've got a lot on the plate over the next few months. We wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we can catch back up with you down the road.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show and pick up a new issue of Men's Journal magazine. Men's Journal magazine has features on health and fitness, adventure and travel, style, and my favorite, the coolest gear hitting the market today. Until next time, I'm Mike Cirelli, and thanks for listening.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.